Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here is what's coming up. After the fatal shooting of Breonna Taylor by police, a grand jury in Kentucky indicts one of three officers. We have reaction from Reverend William Barber. Then, more than 100 of her law clerks act as an honor guard for a lion of the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. How will her lifelong fight for equality and the rule of law be shaped by the next appointment? Plus, new EU asylum rules, but are attitudes to the most vulnerable any different? I'll talk to Alexander Betts, chief migration expert at Oxford University. Welcome to the program. I'm Christiana Manpour in London. Big news from Kentucky tonight. A grand jury indicted one Louisville officer involved in the shooting death of Breonna Taylor. Brett Hankinson was charged with three counts of wanton endangerment in the first degree. The two other officers who were there are not facing charges. You'll remember Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old African-American woman, was shot by police in March when they entered her apartment with a no-knock warrant. Her boyfriend says he did not know they were cops and shot first. The cops, two of them, then shot back, killing Taylor. The death of Breonna Taylor rocked a country and has led to many protests. Joining us now for more on this is the Reverend William Barber, civil rights activist and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, and incredibly vocal, obviously, in the current national reckoning for racial justice. William Barber, it's really important that we talk to you because you heard the Kentucky Attorney General appeal to everybody, activists, religious, civilians, law enforcement, to be responsible at this moment. I wonder what you made of the decision by the grand jury, and what we said actually may not be quite correct. The Kentucky Attorney General said it is not clear at this time which of any of the bullets that were fired actually was the fatal one. So what do you make of the indictment on three counts of wanton endangerment in the first degree?
Well, first of all, I want to remind folk that this is McConnell's former lawyer. And he sounded at the end like an old white supremacist in the South that basically blamed the protest on outsiders. And then he conflated the protest with violence when the only violence has really been done that's taken life and destroyed life in Kentucky has been that of the officers. He didn't make any commitment that he would stand behind the call for a full federal investigation. This indictment erases the very name of Breonna Taylor. Didn't even mention. It's more about endangerment to the neighbors and wanton actions. And for him to say that the truth has been found, I'm from the South. And we know a lot of times when grand juries come back, citizens like that, the truth has not been found. In fact, the grand jury doesn't find the truth. A grand jury simply says whether or not there needs to be a trial to find the truth. He's saying that there doesn't even need to be a trial to find the truth. And when you say doesn't know which bullet, he knows a bullet from all of those that were shot. We also know that there should this no-knock warrant is wrong in the first place. And so the first thing I want to say, several other things, but I want to say this very clearly, because we're going to deal with racism. Just because the Attorney General is Black does not mean he gets a pass on criticism. And he, too, is an enabler of racism if he allows these officers not to be tried in the courts, the trial. Civil lawsuits that an insurance company is paying don't become an answer to murder by officers of the state. There needs to be a trial. And that's why ultimately we need a federal law that holds police officers accountable for when they kill innocent unarmed black people, and they can be tried for murder at the federal level. But to not even have a trial, every American, regardless of race, creed, or color, should be really, really, really concerned about that. To have all of this happen and not even have a trial, and then to erase the person that was killed out of the final decision is horrific. And protesters nonviolently should be protesting, but protesters have been protesting nonviolent. The violence here has been perpetrated by a no-knock warrant and all of this shooting that already a civil suit said was wrongful death. And even today's one indictment says there was wantonness that there shouldn't have been. So there's no reason there shouldn't be an indictment and the truth be sought in court.
Reverend Barber, I was under the impression that there would be a trial under this one indictment. But can I ask you...
There will be a trial on that one indictment,
yes,
but not
yep.
issues, murder, and other issues. Yeah.
Right. So I want to read a short statement from Ben Crump, who's the attorney for the family of Breonna Taylor. He said of this decision, this is, quote, not what we fully wanted, but brings us closer to justice.
Yeah.
If the family's attorney is saying that, how should people like yourself and people on the street react now?
Just what I just said. It's not what we wanted. It is an indictment. We still now have the federal case. We don't know if we can trust Barr on this, but we should continue to push. That's what we always do in the movement. Mm-hmm. I've been a part of cases where people have been in jail, wrongfully in jail, black men, for 20 and 40 years for crimes they didn't do. And we kept pushing until we got them out. We need to keep pushing here until justice is found. This one decision of an attorney general does not in any way suggest that the movement shouldn't keep pushing, lawyers couldn't keep pushing. We should keep calling for what we know should happen, and that is a full trial on these matters. Listen, police used a battering ram and a no-knock warrant, which should be illegal, to break into Breonna Taylor's home and shoot her 5 times. Yes, there was a shot back, but the no-knock warrant is problematic in the first place. And anything less than indictments for a full extent of the officer's actions ultimately cannot stand. That's why Crump is exactly right. It's a step, an indictment, but it's not what we want. And we have to continue to work for full justice in the society. They endangered the neighbors, as this indictment says, but Breonna Taylor got a casket. And not a single officer is charged for that and tried in court. Notice what the movement is even saying. We're not even saying right now they should be found guilty. We're saying it should at least be a trial in court. So I agree with my dear friend Ben Crump. This is not what we wanted. It's a step. But but justice is a journey. Justice is a complete trip. So we have all along the history of civil rights, we have to take steps and keep on stepping. We have to take something, and we have to keep on pushing.
Reverend Barber, you know, for many of us looking from the outside, the United States is a very complicated place on many, many levels, especially on perhaps law and order and the criminal justice system. You heard the Attorney General there saying that, yes, people outside may not understand this, but our law here in Kentucky could not find any reason to indict or bring charges against the two who, as you say, opened the door, no-knock warrant, battering ram. He laid out the case whereby Breonna Taylor's boyfriend fired the first shot, he says, because he thought he didn't know they were cops, and then they fired back. And he said, in that regard, those two, not Hankinson, but those two, are therefore under Kentucky law. There's nothing Kentucky law can do about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a politician talking. Let me just say a first couple of things. First of all, we haven't had a trial, so we don't even know if the no-knock warrant was justified. We don't know what went into it. That's what a trial would bring out. We don't know if race was a part of why they went there in the first place. Also, that's why we're pushing for federal law. And doesn't it say something that states can have various laws that can allow people to not even be tried for cases like this? This comes out of the old South, remember. The South, a lot of times, has had laws that eventually had to be challenged at the federal level and had to be turned around, because too often these states do pass laws like no-knock warrant. They do pass laws that protect officers from indictment when they shouldn't be protected. That's protected from indictment. That's why we need not just a reckoning around racism, but a reconstruction, an examination of these laws. This woman is dead. She got a casket, and no one is even being tried in court. She was unarmed. She was asleep. She was in her own home. This whole case is problematic. But when you shut it down and you don't even allow cross-examination, that grand jury doesn't do cross-examination like that. You don't do cross-examination. You don't bring it into court. Then we don't know all of the dynamics of the case. So this is a step, but it's not the final step. And I suspect we'll be working on this case for a long time to come. And more is going to eventually come out, I would suspect, as it has done in other situations. But just to erase her and to say it's over, the insurance company pay for wrongful death, the cops continue to go on, activists and all need to challenge that. And it's not activists outside of Kentucky. It's people right there in Kentucky and others joining with them from Kentucky saying there's something wrong with the laws when you can't even have a basic indictment and a trial. And I want to emphasize that, Sister Anna, a trial.
Yes. Again, to be clear to the viewers, there presumably will be at least one trial, but you're saying there should be for all of them. Now, let me ask you this. Let me ask
and
you this.
And a trial about her death, not just about endangering people. A woman got a casket.
One of those bullets of his apparently went into her body, according to the Attorney General. So presumably that will be part of the trial. We will have to watch this very carefully, obviously.
Yeah,
but can I ask you?
We don't know that, and we don't know if it'll be for murder. We don't know what it'll be for. We've got a lot more to do on this case. And this is what we have to do in this moment. We have to keep pushing. It's a step, but it's not the final.
As her lawyer said, the family lawyer said, there's the bigger picture, obviously. Breonna Taylor was a major, major victim, a major part, a major brick in this wall of the racial upheaval that is happening in the United States. Her death, obviously, which is why we're talking about it, triggered so much protest and so much agony in your community. And of course, George Floyd's adding to the number of people who have been killed around the world as well.
Right.
What do you think this ruling, this grand jury indictment today says about the greater hope in your community that racial justice will be dealt with properly in the United States, and this Black Lives Matter moment, which is a movement, will actually move ahead?
Well, let's I think restate just a little bit. In the American community, all of our community, in this culture, in humanity, in this point in the world, remember, while we talk about George Floyd, it took George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and by the way, it took a long time for Breonna Taylor to be lifted up. And then there are many others whose names aren't called. Then you had Tamir Rice. You've had shootings down. This is not something that has just happened, right? King was talking about police brutality in 1963. And police brutality and death by police brutality is one area of necropolitics, the politics of death that's impacting Black people and brown people, the death that come from healthcare, the death that come from the denial of wages and what we see even happening with coronavirus. So at some point, America's going to have to deal with the politics of death. And we're going to be honest about the politics of death. For instance, imagine all white officers knocking on the door and breaking through the door of a white family and shooting someone. Imagine what you haven't had that case. Imagine what would happen. And that's what people are saying. We recognize that there would be a very different set of justice, just like there's a very different way in terms of the way people responded to President Obama and people respond to Trump. Imagine if Obama had gone around saying that some of the things that he has said, Trump has said about protests. When we talk about racism, the systemic racism, it has many layers. It has many layers. And this is not just this moment. What you see in the streets is a combination of moments throughout history, a continuation, constantly happening. You know, whether somebody shot in the back at a drive-through in Atlanta or lynched by knee in Minneapolis or shot in their own home innocently in Louisville, and I could, or a small kid shot by a cop and then his sister not even be allowed to reach him into Tamir Rice. You go on and on and on and on. And then on top of that, all the other death that grows out of systemic racism and power and problems. So this is not just a moment for the Black community. This is a moment for America. And it's not just a moment. It's a moment in time that's built on top of all the time, mm-hmm. all the mm-hmm. time that we constantly see this again and again and again. And people know in their heart, they know in their heart that if it was a Black cop had his knee on the top of a white man on camera, it would be very different. They know if it was a Black cop shooting a white man running away, it'd be very different. They know deep down in inside of them, they know if it was all Black officers, no knock warrant, breaking through, killing unarmed a white woman and mother, very different, very different. We see it, we know it, we've seen it down through history. And so at some point, we're gonna have to be truthful about this. And for this attorney general to simply hide, if you will, behind Kentucky law. Go back in history and remember when Southern governors used to say the same thing. Well, we don't do that down here in Alabama. That's not how we do in Mississippi. That's not how we act in North Carolina, South Carolina. And we don't like these people coming down here telling us what to do. Well, if the people had not done that and had not raised up, we wouldn't have voting rights. We wouldn't have the end of segregation. We wouldn't have had desegregation. We wouldn't have had an investigation around the death yep. of Swanna, mm-hmm. Cheney, and Goodman. So these are very serious matters, and we have to take them very seriously.
We do indeed, and we thank you for being with us tonight on this very serious day, very serious occasion. Thank you, Reverend Barber. Now, today, America also said goodbye to a legendary Supreme Court justice whose whole life was about equality, fairness, and human rights. More than 100 of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's law clerks served as honorary pallbearers as her casket was brought to the Supreme Court for a ceremony presided over by the Chief Justice and attended by the remaining 8 on the bench. Her casket was then placed outside under the portico, and on Friday she'll be moved to the U.S. Capitol, where she'll be the very first woman in history to lie in state there, the very first woman. As mourners pay their respects, President Trump appears to have a Senate majority for his pick to fill the vacant seat, this before he's even announced his nomination. President Trump has an extraordinary judicial legacy. His first term has been bookended by fights over a Supreme Court vacancy. 2016 saw Senate Republicans refuse to consider President Obama's nomination of Judge Merrick Garland. They insisted the next elected president should fill the seat. So, what do Republicans hope to achieve with their upcoming appointment? With me to discuss this is Carrie Severino. She is the president of the Judicial Crisis Network, and she was instrumental in ensuring another of Trump's nominees, Brett Kavanaugh, his confirmation. And she's joining me now from Washington. Ms. Severino, thank you for joining us. You know, on this day where we see Judge Ginsburg lying in repose at the Supreme Court, I just want to ask you, as a fellow female legal jurist, what does she mean? What does her legacy mean to you?
One of the pleasures of clerking at the Supreme Court was meeting some of the other justices. And one of the things I enjoyed was getting to have Justice Ginsburg invite my group of clerks for tea in her chambers. It was a wonderful chance to meet someone who I very much respect as a pathbreaker, as a woman and a mother myself. I so admire what she has been able to achieve, especially in an era where it was very difficult for women to even get a job in the field of law. And she obviously achieved things at the highest levels, and her commitment to her family, to her own willingness to help her own husband through law school. He was going through cancer at the time. She went to classes for both of them. So she basically practically has 2 law degrees out of the process. Really an inspiration, I think, for many women. And I'm excited to see another woman now follow in her footsteps and carry on that trailblazing path.
Well, you seem to know that it is a woman. I'm going to ask you that in a second. But as you know, clearly, this idea of so rapidly filling her seat or bringing a nominee to consideration has caused quite a lot of bewilderment, some sadness, of course, and anger, because, as I mentioned, it was clear that President Obama was prevented by the very same Senate Majority Leader from bringing his nomination even to a vote. I guess what I want to ask you is, how seemly is it? You know, she hasn't even been laid in the ground yet. President Trump apparently will wait until she is buried on Saturday. But how seemly do you think it is to rush this through Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell within hours of her death saying that we are going to bring this fight to the Senate floor, this nomination to the Senate floor?
Well, as Justice Ginsburg herself said, a president doesn't stop being a president in his fourth year of office. This is something that every time there's been a vacancy during a election year, the president has made a nomination. And we know the precedent is that Justice Ginsburg herself was confirmed nearly unanimously in only 42 days. Sandra Day O'Connor in 33 days, unanimously confirmed. Justice Stevens in 16 days was unanimously confirmed. So there's a great deal of precedent for this type of a quick confirmation. And the women that the president, it seems like, are on his final shortlist are people who have recently been confirmed by bipartisan majorities by the Senate. So it's a process that I think it's appropriate to obviously give a moment to remember Justice Ginsburg's memory, but especially going into an election year where there's a possibility of important cases that could split 4-4 on the court. I think it also makes sense to fill the seat and to move forward so there is a full complement of justices to address those important issues.
So I did obviously a bit of reading, and there has never been such a rapid turnover as the one that's being considered right now. I mean, the last time there was a rapid one was in 1916, so that was a long time ago. Justice Ginsburg herself took the trouble on her deathbed to dictate to her own granddaughter that her most fervent wish was that her replacement be made by the next president, whoever it might be, President Trump or President Biden. But that was her wish. And, you know, back in 2016, it was your organization and even the Senate Majority Leader who said the American people should decide when you rejected Merrick Garland. The American people should decide. We're on the verge of an election which may change the landscape, and they're not being given the chance to decide. What do you say about that?
So the historical precedent in these cases is every time there's a vacancy in an election year, the president has made a nomination. And it really depends what happens with that vacancy depends on the control of the Senate. In 2016, the White House and the Senate were controlled by different parties. Effectively, the American people giving the Senate back the GOP midway through President Obama's term is them tapping the brakes. In that kind of case, there's a tie effectively between the White House and the Senate. The American people were the tiebreakers in that case, and they chose to have Donald Trump fill that seat. And historically, when the White House and the Senate are held by the same party almost every single time in American history, in election year vacancies, those have been filled. So this is the way the Senate, the Constitution simply arranges it. There is a White House and Senate combined effort that goes into the process. When those are held by the same party, it's no surprise the vacancies are filled. And that's, I think, what we're going to see in 2020.
I think you've just said exactly it. When they're held by the same party, it's no surprise. It's a power play. So I want to ask you, since you have the Senate majority right now, and right now you have the White House, what is it that you are trying to achieve? And I say you because your organization and you yourself are very, very committed to putting, you know, conservative judicial nominees on all the courts, including the Supreme Court. At this moment, what is it that you want to achieve in the Supreme Court, particularly if it becomes a 6-3 conservative majority?
Well, first of all, I'll say that the arguments being made by the Democrats in this is not the power question. It has to do with the power the American people give to the Senate. The Democrats are making the argument in 2016. Many people, including my former professor Liz Warren, said it would actually be unconstitutional not to hold a vote. I think that's ludicrous, but I would point out that that's a very clear shift, and that their argument seems to have to be with if it's our nominee, we want the vote, and if it's not, we don't want the vote, rather than reflecting what the American people have said at the ballot box. In terms of what our organization would like to see in the court, and I'm happy to say I think that lines up with what President Trump and Leader McConnell want to see in the court, it is justices who will be faithful to the Constitution and the rule of law. That is looking at what the actual text of the law is that's passed, the actual text of the Constitution as written. And I think that that's something that all Americans can agree on. That means if a law is a law that was passed by a Democratic Congress and signed by a Democratic president, the result is probably going to be one that is a more liberal result. And that is something that we do see. You see many times these judges who have results that they might not agree with because they think a law is badly written or should be updated. But nonetheless, they feel limited by the actual text of the law. And then that becomes Congress's role, as the Constitution intended, to update those laws. Similarly with the Constitution, if it used to be a constitutional amendment to change things, we have done that 27 times in our history. That's how you change the Constitution, not by judges. I think putting that back in the proper constitutional role will take the politics out of the court process and put it back in the halls of Congress, where laws are supposed to be passed under our Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the conservative view on the interpretation, if you like, of the Constitution or the literal using of it. But can I ask you this? Because you said, has there been? Do you know who is the nominee going to be? I thought I heard you say at the beginning there is a nominee. You don't know?
I don't. I'm saying a woman because the president has said several times he's committed that it's going to be a woman. The front runners appear to be Amy Coney Barrett and Barbara Lagoa. I don't personally know. I'm not sure the president yet knows who it's going to be between those two women.
Let's just read out a little bit. So the Amy Coney Barrett, former clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia, also, as you remember, a good friend of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's. And Barbara Lagoa, Cuban-American from Florida, also appointed to the federal bench by Donald Trump. How would you assess each candidate? And what bits of the law, what is it that you want to affect? Is it women's rights? Is it reproductive freedoms? Is it the continued rollback of the 1965 Voting Rights Act? What is it that you want this new appointee to be able to do?
Right. So if you look at these women that the president is looking at, Amy Coney Barrett, for example, she's a Seventh Circuit judge right now. She, as you mentioned, clerk for Justice Scalia. She's someone who I feel like is a real pathbreaker in the mold of someone like Justice Ginsburg. Obviously, a different judicial approach. And Ginsburg herself said, I want people to know that women come in all shapes and sizes, and they're not going to agree on all issues. I think we all recognize that. And I think in the ways that she was a pathbreaker, being a mother, she's a mother of seven, two of those children adopted from Haiti. In the meantime, she has simultaneously achieved at the highest levels of her profession, tenured professor at Notre Dame. Every one of her faculty colleagues endorsed her, even those who obviously disagree with her, which is quite a few of them, on maybe politics or on jurisprudence. They said she's absolutely outstanding. And she now, of course, is as well as being a mother, a scholar, now a judge. Barbara Lagoa, you mentioned, she's the daughter of Cuban immigrants. Her father said he had wanted to go to law school but was unable to because they were fleeing a tyrannical regime in Cuba to come to America. And she speaks so eloquently about how she came here and her parents came here because of wanting the rule of law for their children. So she has a commitment, and you can see that in her track record since 2006 on the bench, of cases where she says, I know that it's a judge's role to interpret the law as it's written. I don't think the judges should be able to make it up as they go. That's the kind of regime my parents abandoned in Cuba because they want to live under a rule of law. Again, another mother, a just pathbreaking woman, first Hispanic woman on the Florida Supreme Court, and I think would also be a very worthy successor to Justice Ginsburg in terms of this kind of role model that we're holding up for younger women.
I think Judge Sotomayor may take exception to that.
She wouldn't be the first Hispanic woman on the Supreme Court, obviously.
Right,
and they
can
differ. But I think it's still a really admirable role model. I think that one of the things Justice Ginsburg taught us is we can very much admire and respect and learn lessons from people, even when we may disagree with them about issues like politics, like their jurisprudence.
That would be good if we could get past this terrible, poisonous partisanship in the United States right now. But I need to play your own ads to you, because it's again about this differing criteria. You had one set of criteria in 2016 and another now. This is your organization, your paid ads. We're going to play it.
The Supreme Court has a vacancy, and your vote in November is your only voice. Senator Mitch McConnell agrees the American people should decide. This isn't about Republicans or Democrats. It's about your voice. You choose the next president. The next president chooses the next justice.
In 8 out of 10 vacancies like this, the nominee was confirmed. Democrats are shamefully trying to change the facts. Tell the Senate, when a strong nominee is named, follow precedent. Confirm the judge.
Again, I'm sitting outside the United States, but it makes no sense to me. That's an absolute, you know, they're in conflict, those two statements. The people should decide.
I would say, right. As I was explaining earlier, the people in 2016, well, go back to 2014. All right. President Obama was in office. The people All right. gave the Senate to the GOP, giving that a breaks on his administration. And then the people had the opportunity to break that tie. In 2020, it's different. The power is united with the Senate and the White House.
All right. And I'm going to put that to our next guest, Carrie Severino. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. And so listening is Neil Katyal. He is a Supreme Court lawyer and a former U.S. acting Solicitor General under President Obama, joining me now from Washington. Welcome to the program, Neil Katyal. Can I just ask you to pick up from the last question I asked Ms. Severino about, you know, what looks like changing standards, but she said it's up to the people. The people have elected these senators, and the two vacancies are not the same.
Yeah, I'm not really sure, Christiane, why you or your viewers should listen to that person or believe her this time. She just told you on air, quote, a president doesn't stop being president in his fourth year. And here's what she told the Washington Post 4 years ago, quote, in the middle of an election year, it makes the most sense to let the people have a voice. Or she said to Newsmax, quote, let's let the American people decide and see what they say. There's none of this talk of the Senate control or anything like that. She said the absolute reverse 4 years ago. It is emblematic of the fact that these folks have torched honor. They've torched principle. They'll say anything. And you're absolutely right. This is just a power play. 4 years ago, her organization even went and threatened a Republican senator, Senator Moran, just because he wanted to have a confirmation hearing for Merrick Garland. And this is not some hypocrisy about some irrelevant thing like sports teams or something like this. This is about the crown jewel in the American democracy, our Supreme Court. And these people are monkeying with it, breaking all principle. They're trying to break the Supreme Court just because they're afraid they're going to lose an election. And I think it is so corrosive. It's one of the maybe the worst thing I've seen in my 20 plus years in Washington.
Well, as I said to Ms. Severino, I had done the reading, and no vacancy at the Supreme Court has occurred so close to a presidential election in American history. It's never been filled by a Senate vote before the election like this. The closest came in 1916. But so what do you think now? What do you anticipate? You can see the arrayed power, and it is power, arrayed to get this through right now. And I put that to her as well, that you have a president, you have a Senate. It looks like Mitch McConnell has a majority. We don't even know who the nominee is. But so what should we expect to unfold now?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right, Christiane, about the precedent. I'm glad you've done the work. You know, you heard Ms. Severino talk about the Sandra Day O'Connor precedent. It wasn't even an election year. It was 1982. So all of her precedents don't make any sense. There's only one precedent that's close, and that's Abraham Lincoln, because Chief Justice Taney died 27 days before the 1864 election. And even in the midst of the Civil War, when you had a Chief Justice who basically sparked the Civil War with his Dred Scott decision, Abraham Lincoln didn't say, oh, I'm going to fill this with my guy. He said, I'm going to wait for the election and let the person who wins decides. So if the Republicans go and do this and break with precedent, as to use your words, a power play, I do think that it will ultimately lead to massive reprisals and the Supreme Court and the American people will suffer. I don't see how the Democrats won't be able to resist increasing the size of the Supreme Court to 13 or 15 people and nominating, you know, people to fill those slots. And then the Republicans, if they win in 2028, may make it 19 or 21. And ultimately, we'll have a Supreme Court the size of Switzerland with 40 members or something like that. That's horrible. And it goes to my fundamental point, which is these people have abandoned all principle. They don't care about the court. They don't care about our democracy. And they're willing to do whatever they can just to get another vote up there. And it's so sad. It breaks my heart.
Okay, so that's your view, but I want to know what you think of the facts, because it is not clear that even if they get you know, more conservatives. Well, maybe it is clear. But up until now, with the 5-4, not everything has gone the conservative way. I don't know how surprised you were, but many major 5-4 votes in the past few years, and just recently, the Chief Justice, Roberts, siding with liberals on DACA, the Dreamers, on a pro-choice case, and on an LGBT case. Okay, so that's 5-4. But I think conservatives were surprised that the conservatives didn't side necessarily with the conservatives on the court, didn't side with the administration or perhaps even the people who put them on the court with their money and their organization.
I'm so glad, Christiane, that you raised that because, you know, that is the beauty of our Supreme Court up until now. I mean, think about 2012. In that election year, Chief Justice Roberts, who was appointed by a Republican president, George W. Bush, crosses the lines and votes to uphold President Obama's signature initiative, the Affordable Care Act, and really helping him in the 2012 election, not intentionally, but because he thought that was the best view of the law. That is largely the way the Supreme Court operates. And now you've got Republican senators saying, Josh Hawley saying, I will not vote to confirm someone unless they pledge to overturn Roe versus Wade ahead of time. And that's what they're looking for. So they're not looking for justices in the mold of the Chief Justice. Indeed, you've heard President Trump go and attack the Chief Justice at various times. So I wish that was, you know, what was going on. It's just not.
I want to play you something that Mitt Romney said, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, who's, as you know, not always stood with President Trump. In fact, you know, used his vote against him during the impeachment process. He said the following, because he's decided to approve whoever the president, or not approve, to approve to bring it to the debate, to the Judiciary Committee. This is what he said about that.
I recognize that we may have a court which has more of a conservative bent than it's had over the last few decades. But my liberal friends have, over many decades, gotten very used to the idea of having a liberal court. And that's not written in the stars. It's also appropriate for a nation which is, if you will, center-right, to have a court which reflects center-right points of view.
Okay, so two statements there which are interesting. One, the statement that America is center-right. Maybe it is. I mean, I don't know. You can comment on that. And the other is that my liberal friends have got very used to having a liberal court over the decades.
So Senator Romney cast a very courageous vote on impeachment, and I think all Americans should be proud of that, and it'll go down in history. That statement was not his finest hour. There have been 18 of the 18 most recent nominations to the Supreme Court of people who become justices. 14 have been by Republican presidents. So this idea that it's a liberal Supreme Court, you know, that's the first I've ever heard of it. I've taught constitutional law for 20 years. I've literally never heard that phrase before. Most of my time practicing at the Supreme Court, it's been with 7 Republican appointees and 2 Democratic ones. Right now, there are 3 Democratic ones. So I honestly just don't know exactly what he's trying to say there.
So I want to ask you, in light of what former Labor Secretary Robert Reich has tweeted yesterday, and I'm going to read it to you in a second, but it goes to whether the court is actually representative of America. He tweeted, a 6th GOP justice nominated by an impeached president who lost the popular vote by 3 million, confirmed by GOP senators representing 15 million fewer Americans than their Democratic colleagues after Obama's pick couldn't even get a vote. When I say the system is rigged, this is what I mean. So do you think the system is rigged? And how representative are the justices of America and Americans? And I talk also in this moment of justice that's being demanded for Black Americans, for African Americans.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, you can look at if President Trump gets his nominee through and you have 15 of 19 justices appointed by one party, that could be seen as representative of where the country is. I think the country is, you know, evenly split, and the Supreme Court composition has not been evenly split at all. And I think Secretary Reich is right to point to what the Republicans are doing, which is trying to disenfranchise voters in state after state and all sorts of things, mail-in ballots, this, that, and the other, any sort of rubric they can to try and bolster their voting power at the polls and now at the U.S. Supreme Court. So there is a direct relationship between these things. And ultimately, I think these folks are afraid of democracy. They're afraid of things like the Voting Rights Act, which is why they want their justices to strike it down. And it's a sad moment. I think we will get past it. I think that there's nothing more fundamental than for Americans than the right to vote. And I think we will ultimately see that for what it is, and there'll be a new birth of American democracy. But I do think it's going to take a lot of effort.
Well, let me ask you this final question. I'm going to play a little soundbite from President Trump, who says why they need to fill this seat before the election.
We need 9 justices. You need that. With the unsolicited millions of ballots that they're sending, it's a scam, it's a hoax, everybody knows that, and the Democrats know it better than anybody else. So you're going to need 9 justices up there. I think it's going to be very important.
So, I mean, you know, we always have to say no evidence of mail fraud. This is the president's rallying cry, but it's not based in reality. However, what do you expect to unfold on election night, and what role, given what we saw in Bush versus Gore in 2000, how could the Supreme Court become embroiled?
Well, President Trump has said a lot of outrageous things in his 4 years and before he became president. But what he just said, what you just played, is among the most outrageous. To someone like me who practices before the Supreme Court, who reveres the institution, the idea that he has to get another justice up there to help him in the election I find just so sad and so corrosive. It's antithetical to everything the court is about. And you're absolutely right, Christian. There could be any number of election disputes about the right to vote, about mail-in ballots, about state legislatures and their role in the process. Any of this could go to the Supreme Court. And I don't think anyone should be sitting there saying, oh, I need my justice to get up there and do my bidding for me, which is, you know, what he is implying there. Okay. You know, I think past presidents have been very reticent to make any sort of comments about cases that might come before the Supreme Court.
We really do live in extraordinary times. Neil Katyal, thank you so much indeed for joining us. And now we're going to turn to the European Union, where a new asylum policy is being unveiled. The much-anticipated proposals would aim to avoid disasters like the recent fire at the Moria camp on the Greek island of Lesbos, Europe's largest migrant camp. And this fire left around 13,000 people without shelter. Just take a listen.
Me house this finished. As far as many, all finished.
There's a really big fire and almost all the camp burned. And we don't know where to go, and all the refugees are outside and try to find a place to just at least stay.
Well, their sad lives further upended, and for years the EU has been criticized for not getting member states to take their fair share of refugees. With me now to discuss this is Alexander Betts. He's professor of forced migration and international affairs at Oxford University. Welcome back to the program. It's a long time since we've talked about immigration and migration and refugees, but clearly this terrible fire in Greece has focused everybody's attention. What did you hear in terms of sharing the burden from the new EU proposals?
So the tragedy of Moria was really avoidable and inevitable as a consequence of the European Union's failure to develop responsibility sharing for European states to cooperate adequately in relocating people in grossly inadequate shelter on the Greek islands. And what we've seen since 2015 is that the EU member states have failed to come to an agreement because they've stuck rigidly to the so-called Dublin regulation, which means that the frontline states like Greece and Italy take responsibility initially to process asylum claims and protect refugees. That's meant that Greece has effectively become the warehouse for refugees. Now, the new proposals, this migration and asylum pact, large parts of it are fairly politically uncontroversial. They're about trying to manage irregular migration into the EU. But there's one element of it, which is trying to move beyond Dublin and have a new relocation deal. The problem is that once it reaches the political stage and European countries have to actually agree on a practical situation, the likelihood is that deadlock will persist. So what I've heard in the deal is a move towards something that would be quite voluntary, that when we get large influxes to Greece and Italy, there'll be an attempt to relocate the most vulnerable, families and children across Europe, but it will be a voluntary commitment, and the deal is yet to hit the political fan.
Well, hit the political fan, that's a good way of putting it. There's been some rather extraordinary descriptions of what all this means. Basically, also reporters pointing out that absolutely nothing has been shown to even move the dial other than terrible tragedies, whether it's a migrant boat sinking, whether it's, you know, refugees washed up on beaches, or now this terrible fire. That's one thing. Nothing gets done until something terrible happens and all the pictures are around. But also, this is one that's being, you know, being described as, let the humanitarians sound humane and the hardliners sound hard. Essentially saying, okay, let the willing European countries bring in refugees and migrants, and those who don't want to, a lot of East European and other countries, let them do some of the other work. What is the other work? I mean, I read that it's like, let them do the deportations. Can you explain what's the humanitarian work and what's the hard work?
Well, this pact is trying to provide something for everybody. EU member states are in different positions. We've seen countries like Hungary, Poland, Austria, very reticent to accept more refugees and asylum seekers. Other countries like Germany trying to provide ongoing leadership for more solidarity. Now, the thing about the relocation deal is it says that countries can basically commit on their own terms. So some might take in refugees relocated from Greece and Italy, but for others, they might contribute in other ways, through financial support, through providing money effectively to support returns. So if some countries really don't want to relocate refugees onto their territory, they might simply contribute to paying for the return of failed asylum seekers back to the countries they've come from. And it's that element which is framed as solidarity, but has a heavy element of voluntarism that means basically there's probably a lack of teeth in this agreement. And it's an attempt to be, in many ways, all things to all people. It talks about balancing responsibility and solidarism, but in a way it's a pragmatic attempt to be agreeable to all. But the risk is that it therefore doesn't achieve very much in terms of binding commitments to cooperation.
And you spend your life and your career studying the ways around this and how to try to have a humane policy. You know, we're talking 10,000 people, those people in Moria camp, we're talking 10,000 people, and we can't find countries to take, you know, to divide that number between them. What does that just say about the continent right now?
Well, we really have all the evidence we need at the moment that the political will to protect refugees is not there in Europe, that some of the basic values that underpin the European Union of human rights, of solidarity, of support for refugees are not there. And while this new pact aspires to build lasting, sustainable cooperation, the reality we see is that that's just not there, that 13,000 people can be made homeless by fires in the camp in Moria on the Greek islands. And yet a handful of European countries have come forward and said, okay, we'll take a few hundred children, we'll relocate some families, but that we're really trying to scrape the barrel of solidarity just for those 13,000 people says it all. And I think a big side of the European debate is about externalizing this, outsourcing responsibility now to countries like Libya. And when the EU is really trying to outsource its human rights obligations to a failed state like Libya, it highlights that behind everything that's going on, there's a really challenging politics in Europe. Not only the rise in populist nationalism we saw before COVID-19, but what COVID is going to do for recession, for the economy, and the politics of immigration and asylum in Europe. So we're at a very low ebb. It's very worrying for people who believe in human rights and refugee protection. And we really need not only leadership by the European Commission, but the states to step forwards and say, OK, the numbers are much lower than in 2015-16. This is a global challenge, a global shared responsibility. And if we expect countries around the world, some of the poorest countries in the world that host the majority of refugees, and it's 85% of the world's refugees are in low and middle income countries. Most are not in Europe, they're not in North America. If those countries, the Jordans, Lebanons, Turkeys, Uganda, Kenya, if those countries can take most refugees, we have to show that there's a global shared commitment to protect refugees who are fleeing conflict and violence and persecution.
I mean, it's extraordinary to remember that Angela Merkel of Germany took 1 million in 2015. And now, as you say, the attitudes have really hardened. But you mentioned Libya, and I want to ask you about this, because EU documents, investigations into this issue have revealed that the EU has been, I think, funding and training and providing boats to the Libyan Coast Guard, as you say, in this failed state, to try to prevent migrants from getting on the boat and crossing the Mediterranean. And they admitted, apparently, in a 2019 leaked report, that the Coast Guard can't monitor the Libyan Coast Guard. Detaining migrants is, quote, a profitable business model for Libya's government. You know, what does that mean? What is going on between the EU and Libya and these poor migrants?
Europe is collaborating with a failed state in order to outsource responsibility, not just for migration, but for people who probably are in need of international protection. Since 2017, the European Union has returned about 40,000 people seeking to claim asylum in Europe to Libya. And the EU, for instance, funds the Libyan Coast Guard. And only in July this year, there was a substantiated report that showed that EU-funded Libyan Coast Guard had shot three Sudanese refugees for failing to cooperate. We know from stories from many human rights organizations that Libya has become a detention black hole, that there are detention centers being run by militias in which many migrants are being sold into prostitution, into slavery. This is a country that is run by militias, where the internationally recognized government has really tenuous control over part of Tripoli, yes, but certainly not the whole country. And yet Europe is relying to a great extent on Libya and other transit countries as the basis for its attempts to manage the flows mm-hmm. of irregular migration. And when we see in this new pact ideas like the rapid return of failed asylum seekers, we have to question whether the quality of the asylum process will be adequate and whether we risk sending people who face a really well-founded fear of persecution in the countries they've come from. If we risk sending them back to countries like Libya, they may face very serious harm.
Okay, let me just ask you, because we've got a short time left. Also, rescue workers and aid organizations, NGOs, have been almost criminalized, if not actually criminalized, by the EU. There's a Europe-wide crackdown on aid workers who are helping migrants. Another EU-funded research paper found that 158 individuals have been investigated or prosecuted on grounds of smuggling, money laundering, and membership of a criminal organization since 2015. I mean, what is this happening? I mean, what's your read of what's happening to these NGOs and aid organizations?
Well, there's been a long-term crackdown on what's broadly called facilitation. Anybody, even private actors, airlines, international organizations, NGOs, that are seen to help people get into the European Union on an irregular or illegal basis can face serious legal sanction, even criminal sanction. And the idea of clamping down on smuggling networks and criminal gangs makes sense. But a lot of the legislation across the European Union, including it from individual member states, mm-hmm. is really mm-hmm. criminalizing often very well-meaning people who are trying to support a human rights agenda. And so I think this is all part of an underlying attempt by the European Union to reduce the space for what's called spontaneous arrival asylum. I think when I listen to conversations amongst ministers in governments across Europe, there's a real sense that they feel that spontaneous arrival asylum is no longer sustainable in the current context, given rising populist nationalism, given the likelihood of serious recession. And I think for everybody who cares about human rights, there's a real danger that as that protection space is diminished in Europe, as the border closes off, as we make asylum claim assessments more and more rapid and people are returned quickly, that we risk people being really having their human rights undermined. And the institution of refugee protection is at threat if NGOs and human rights organizations are also potentially criminalized for playing any kind of role in, say, rescue at sea or facilitating access to territory for people who are attempting to seek asylum.
Okay, literally 30 seconds. Do you see, I mean, what would your plan be to deal with these migrants who are legitimately now homeless and just people who need asylum?
So I think on a global scale, we have to recognize that most refugees are in lower middle income countries. And the solutions for most are going to be jobs, education, long-term solutions in those host countries, countries like Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya. But Europe has to find a way to leave its door open, and it has to share responsibility amongst the EU 28, soon to be 27. And that involves a recognition that we must have shared responsibility to relocate people from Greece, from Italy, from Malta. And there needs to be the kind of commitment that's in the migration pact, but governments have to take it seriously. Governments have to recognize the numbers are much smaller than they were in 2015 and 2016, that we can, even with COVID-19's impact on the economy, accept a small number of refugees in Europe and show that humanity, that spirit of human rights that has underpinned European values over the last half century.
Alexander Betts, on that note, thank you so much for joining us. And finally, in the annals of political chutzpah, this surely must stand out. The Kremlin is wishing Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny a speedy recovery and says that he is free to return home. This, of course, as the Putin regime is accused of poisoning him with the deadly nerve agent Novichok just over a month ago. They deny it, of course. Navalny's family, though, pushed for him to be treated in a Berlin clinic, and today he was finally discharged. Despite nearly losing his life, Alexei Navalny reportedly plans to return to Russia as soon as he's recovered to continue his fight for Russian democracy and freedom. An inspiring commitment indeed. And that's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.